This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Maternal mortality in Indiana. How prevalent is this issue and what's being done now to improve maternal health care for mothers across the state? We'll be discussing all that and more on the show today. But first, we're going to learn about a new investigative project about maternal mortality in Indiana called Joy in Jeopardy. With us now is Jenna Watson, photojournalist at the Indy Star. Jenna, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's start with this project, Jenna. Where did the idea to do this come from?
Yes. So back in 2019, we had two reporters that really spearheaded this project, London Getson and Emily Hopkins. And London saw a national report about the issue, particularly some really surprising data about obstetric deserts, which are these areas, these counties that don't have inpatient delivery rooms, no obstetric wards. And a third of all the counties in Indiana are obstetric deserts. So about 33 counties out of the 92 we have here in the state. And that's a big lack of access to the right care in those areas. And so that really piqued London's interest. There's been this long-held belief that the maternal mortality rates in Indiana are high, yet the data is shoddy, and it wasn't super clear why, and it wasn't always the most accurate. So that's what inspired them to dig into it a little bit more back in 2019.
And how did you get involved with it?
Yeah, so I partnered with London and Emily. I heard that they were beginning to work on this. It piqued my interest. I care a lot about issues that affect women and other people in marginalized groups here in the state. So it was right up my alley. I wanted to learn more. And with a big project like this, it's best to collaborate early and often with, you know, visuals and data and how we can bridge those two to have our best storytelling possible. So I joined some of those early meetings, and my goal was to bring some faces and kind of real world effects of this to the story.
You mentioned that there wasn't much data and it was pretty shoddy when looking into this initially. Did the lack of that make this project difficult in reporting on?
Yeah, absolutely. So the way our reporters described it, London said, you know, it's not that there wasn't data, but the way it was collected and tracked was not uniform, and it wasn't always accurate. So the state health department would kind of dump the data online, and it wasn't presented in a way that was able to be like analyzed or looked at in a big picture way. And so they used the data when they were starting their investigation and when they were talking to experts and doing their reporting. They used it any way they could. But before the Maternal Mortality Review Committee, which is a really important program that we'll talk about a bit, before that, it just wasn't helpful. And so when this Maternal Mortality Review Committee was formed several years back, it gathers, analyzes, and releases the reports in a way that's helpful, and they can make recommendations from it. And that data is from 2018 and 19 so far. Each of those reports were released in 2020 and 2021, respectively. And that's the first time we're really seeing the true numbers for our state in a practical, you know, real way.
It sounds like there's a bit of a lag then. So 2020 and 2021 haven't come out with data yet, I'm assuming.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so we still, you know, now that we're tracking it in this better way and in this more accurate way, that's great. But, you know, even still, we only have two total years. And so there is still, you know, a lot of gaps in what we know and what we can say about the issue.
Right. And I'm going to assume with the pandemic that data is going to change as well, just the way everything was all over the place. And so when it came to putting this project together, how did the team start their investigation and, I guess, turn this into an investigation versus just a story? It seems like they had to dig in to find the information they needed.
Sure. Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, like I mentioned, they were referencing that data how they could. And when they reached out to experts, the state, they spoke with the Maternal Mortality Review Committee, hospitals, universities, later in the project, mothers. I mean, talking to everybody that has anything to do in the sphere of this topic. So, you know, any systemic issue like this is complex. So the key is to talk to everybody in every corner who might be affected and might play a role in helping. And I think when those reports came out, that changed things. But, you know, just talking to experts any way you could. And another dilemma, too, is that, you know, the review committee looks at deaths, women who die during or after delivery. But, you know, there's all of the people who had near miss situations, who went through a traumatizing experience, and then live with the effects long term that are physical and mental. And so, you know, hearing from those folks is really important too.
Yeah. And just can you remind us of the series? Is it still underway being released, or has it been completed for the Indie Star?
Yeah. So we're publishing in two waves. A couple weeks ago, the first wave of stories published, where we talk about these rural areas, these obstetric deserts. We profiled a couple mothers. We talk about the data itself, which is such an important piece in all this. And then there'll be a second wave of stories in the series coming next week on Wednesday. That'll publish online at indiestar.com and in a series in print over the span of several days.
Now, these kinds of topics can be pretty sensitive for folks to want to share their stories. Did you find it difficult to find mothers to talk about their experiences?
Yeah, so we did do a call out, and that helps with things like this, when you can publicly say, hey, we're looking to talk to folks who have been affected by this. So in fall 2019, we published a story that was a call out, asking to hear from people who'd been affected. And we received messages from more than 60 people, most or all of which were women and people who had given birth who had near miss or other traumatic childbirth experiences. So, you know, what a lot of them had in common, though, which was interesting, you know, obviously they were all willing to share with us and eager to talk about what had happened to them. But most of them thought that they were alone, or that their experience was isolated, or that they had been through some kind of, you know, freak accident experience, I guess you could call it. Many of them didn't know that it was part of this bigger trend, or that things like this happen to hundreds of people who give birth in Indiana every year.
Wow. And so you were able to speak with some of these mothers. Can you tell us some of the mothers you spoke to? Tell us about them.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the stories we've already published, you know, it was a lot of women who live in these rural areas, these obstetric deserts, because that's what the big first story we put out was. And so we hear from Heather Glines, for example. She's a mother who, when she gave birth to her first child in 2013, she was living in an obstetric desert about an hour away from her birthing hospital in Terre Haute. So where she lived, there wasn't a hospital where she could give birth, so she'd be traveling to Terre Haute to give birth. And she went into labor 3 days before the baby was actually born. And so she had to drive to the hospital and back every day leading up to his birth. And so we have a clip of her recalling that experience.
I was freaked out. I didn't want to have the baby in the car. I wanted to have, you know, nurses, and I didn't know what I was doing. I just know the contractions hurt really bad. And then I was thinking, I don't want to hit a deer either. So I didn't drive fast. I just kind of took it easy. And then when I got into Terre Haute, I kind of went a little faster, because I'm like, okay, here's lights everywhere. So, and Union, I didn't even know where I was going. It's a big hospital. So I just dropped myself off in the emergency door, and my husband parked the car. And then after that, they just escorted me up to where I needed to be.
Wow. That's intense. I mean, I can't imagine being in labor and trying to drive, let alone an hour drive.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, the next person we talked to, just as impactful to hear from her, Jen Kimbrough. She lives in Montgomery County. It's near Crawfordsville. It's an obstetric desert. And her delivery hospital was in Danville, which is about 45 minutes or an hour away, depending on traffic. And she gave birth at her birthing hospital, and after she hemorrhaged. And so she had a really, really difficult birth experience. And we have a clip of her recalling that.
It's funny because I vividly remember, like, I just shut my eyes and just instantly started praying. Like, just, and everything went dark and it was quiet, and I just continually praying the same prayer over and over and over again. Like, just let me be his mom. Please let me be his mom. And that's all I remember. For a good span, it was just dark, quiet, and I just prayed that prayer over and over again. And then the next thing I know, my nurse, like, yells my name in my ear, and I open my eyes, I'm like, what? Like, and she's like, don't you ever do that to us again. Your lips turn blue on us. You scared us half to death. And I had no idea anything was going on. And later I asked my husband, I'm like, what happened during this time period that I thought everything was fine? I was just like in my zone. And he's like, you know, they flipped you. Like, your head went down straight and said alarms were going off in the hospital, and they were calling codes, and they were bringing blood in, and they said there was people all over the room, and it was loud and hectic, and I was oblivious to all of that.
And so with Jen Kimbrough, she survived that experience in the hospital, but then about a week later, she was at home late at night and she started bleeding again. And her husband stayed home with the baby, and she didn't know if she could go to her local hospital near where she lived because its obstetric ward had closed several years earlier. And so she decided, you know, my best bet might be to drive to my birthing hospital 45 minutes away. She said she got into the car bleeding. A wave of calm came over her. And she started to drive, and she was able to get there and get the help she needed. But that was yet another traumatizing experience for her on top of what she had just been through a week earlier.
Wow. I mean, I'm impressed and amazed by the strength of these women being able to push through these situations. But also, I mean, I'm sure there's the trauma that's left over afterwards. And so with your reporting on this as a photojournalist, like what was it like for you? Was there anything that struck you that you took away from this?
Yeah, I mean, what you just said, the strength of people who have been through things like this is pretty incredible. It's surprising, but not. I mean, it's amazing that, you know, you can go through something like this, take control and kind of ownership of your own healing the way so many of these people have, and then go the next step to try to turn that experience into action. That's what we found is a lot of these women want to raise awareness, want to reach out to each other, other people who have given birth and been through things like this and push for change.
Well, before we let you go, what do you think these photos say about the story for folks that are checking it out? How does that enhance this series?
Yeah, the challenge for the visual journalist on a series like this is to bring some faces and voices to it. It was so data heavy. It was a lot of stories about things that have happened to people in the past. And so to kind of bring it into the present time, show some solutions angles, hear from mothers and what they've been through, I think that'll be really impactful. And I think that's what I wanted to do, was just create some space for mothers. You know, we hear so much in the childbirth process about the baby and infant health, and that's of course so important, but to hear from mothers and what they've been through and how they keep those experiences with them all those years later, I think that's so important to draw readers in and get them invested in something like this.
Well, thank you so much. Jenna Watson is a photojournalist for the Indy Star and Joy in Jeopardy, an investigative project on maternal mortality in Indiana. Just ahead, what's being done to address maternal mortality in our state? We'll be back after a quick break. I'm Miriam Soap. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. Maternal mortality isn't something we often think of as a present-day issue. It sounds like something we should have tackled by now. But data suggests that it's still a huge problem, and Indiana has seen a decrease in resources for pregnant women. With us now is Dr. Mary Abernathy, chair of Indiana's Maternal Mortality Review Committee. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Abernathy.
Thank you. Thank you, Miriam, for allowing us to discuss some of our findings.
Let's start with the committee working on maternal mortality in the state. How long has this committee been around?
So the committee was formed in 2018 by legislation that Governor Holcomb signed. And it consists of approximately 60 to 65 members all from all around the state. And we have members that are doulas, midwives, nurses, physicians. We have law enforcement, social work. We have behavioral health providers, as well as an addiction specialist. We have a geneticist. We have representatives from the insurance company and Medicaid, as well as public health specialists that help us kind of examine all the facts that we've kind of abstracted from the cases. And then from that information, we determine whether this was related to the pregnancy or just associated to the pregnancy.
This sounds like an all-star team. Is there a reason why nothing like this existed before 2018?
Well, I think part of it has to do with a lot of states didn't have it. It was formed when Jerome Adams came back from a national meeting and said, hey, why don't we have a maternal mortality review committee? And so then members of the State Department of Health, as well as kind of interested providers such as myself, we got our heads together and we knew we needed to work on getting legislation. And so we were able to get that passed, thank goodness, to our legislators in the first session. And the committee was formed in 2018.
Would you say the Maternal Mortality Committee is aimed at looking at things that are happening in the state and solutions for them? Or is this more of a safety net just in case something happens, the state can say, oh, we took care of it?
Oh, no. It's obviously there are two arms to maternal mortality, I like to refer to. This is the study arm. And I think Jenna referred earlier in her segment that the data prior to this was not always accurate. And so this is the most accurate data you're going to get with a review of each case. And then from that, then the committee makes recommendations. Excuse me. And those recommendations, we kind of make recommendations for the state, meaning potentially legislators. We make recommendations for facilities, recommendations for providers, as well as the family and the community. And so we tailor what could have been done and when could someone have done it to prevent a similar death in a similar situation. And so all this information is now very accurately obtained. We have nurse abstractors that will go through the case. They'll pour over the medical records, the law enforcement records, DCS records, any type of records we can obtain related to that mother prior to her death. We will obtain those records and they collect and abstract that case. And then all that is looked into. And so from that, we make recommendations.
So the records that you're able to get to look over and review and make recommendations, are those records that have to be reported or released? Like, is there somewhere where you access this information?
We get it from multiple sources. By law, if you are a healthcare facility or a healthcare provider, you are mandated to report if you're aware of a maternal mortality. The issue that we sometimes find is that it's not always apparent if someone died in another county that they, you know, had a baby in another county, 6 to 8 months ago. And so we have to rely on records, death records, as well as getting their health care records. So we rely on multiple sources to get the information that we can.
How prevalent is this issue in Indiana? I know we mentioned that records weren't always very forthcoming in the past, and now there's this effort to change that. Are we seeing that Indiana is doing better than we thought, or is it not so good?
You know, it kind of depends on what you're looking for specifically. We are seeing that we have comparable rates. However, that's so difficult to determine because other states may not be utilizing a maternal mortality review committee. And we know that, I mean, our state's only been doing it for 2 years. And so our data we know is very accurate for the past 2 years, what we've released. What we normally see out in the media and in the lay public is data that's been either released from the National Center for Health Statistics or the CDC with their PMSS data. And so it's difficult, and sometimes you're comparing apples to oranges. So that's a difficult answer.
Well, when you say the data is coming from the CDC or the NIH, what data do they have that would make it confusing? Are they just averaging like the entire country, or do they also have access to specific state related data?
It's more how they got that data. And what we found even in our committee is that the data that's been submitted previously may not have been accurate. As I mentioned before, you could have a case where a woman died 3 months after she delivered, but she delivered in a different part of the state. And so the person filling out the death certificate may not have always have been aware that she was recently pregnant. And so the CDC, the National Center for Health Statistics, are usually just using the death certificate data for the most part. And you know, there's always going to be some inaccuracies. And that's why the Maternal Mortality Review Committee spends an amazing amount of effort to pore over each of the cases. And, you know, part of what we look at is, do we agree with what's written on the death certificate? Do we think that this death was preventable? Do we think that is there anything that could have been done to prevent a death in a similar situation?
And that's got to be tough to comb through all that material. And with the committee recently releasing a report on data from 2019, what were some of the things that you were able to take away from that report?
So very similar to 2018, unfortunately, accidental drug poisoning overdose still is the largest contributor to the underlying cause of death for all pregnancy-associated deaths, meaning the woman was pregnant or within 1 year of being pregnant. And then the second highest cause is motor vehicle accidents, followed by homicides and suicides and cancer. So those tend to be the same causes of death that you might find in this age population. And so for that, you know, we follow the curve regarding the cause of death for this age group.
And so that's my understanding from what you're saying is that's just a cause of death in general for mothers who've been pregnant or had children. Is there anything specifically that would link being pregnant to a cause of death or lack of awareness from the healthcare practitioner knowing that the mother might have preeclampsia, for example, or something like that?
Oh, definitely. When we look at what cases we call pregnancy related, meaning it's due to a complication caused by the pregnancy, such as a hemorrhage or an amniotic fluid embolism or a condition that was aggravated by the pregnancy, such as Marfan syndrome or diabetes, or when we look at those causes, we see that cardiovascular disease plays an important role. And unfortunately, we even have found ectopic pregnancies, which as an OBGYN provider, you know, I'm sort of shocked that we have had women die due to ectopic pregnancies in this state. In addition, we have women that are dying due to hemorrhage. And so from those specific pregnancy-related cases, the state has created different bundles or protocols. And this has come, you know, under Dr. Box's direction as the state health commissioner. So all the delivering facilities and hospitals in the state where women deliver will have what we call a hemorrhage protocol. So if a pregnant woman in your hospital starts hemorrhaging, these are the steps that you do that are evidence-based. There's also one for hypertension being rolled out. Our next bundle that we're going to be rolling out from the state perspective is related to substance abuse and making sure that women have access to mental health services as well as substance use disorder care.
You mentioned one of the leading causes of death for mothers, something about substance abuse and pregnancy. Why is there a connection there?
I think part of it is many young women will try to self-medicate if they have a mental health illness and they don't have access to a behavioral health or a mental health provider. They'll try to self-medicate and use different whatever they can get their hands on sometimes to help relieve anxiety or depression. Mm-hmm. And so what we've found is that if we can provide increased access to mental health behavior, you know, like Jenna was talking about OB deserts, I suspect we have mental health deserts or behavioral health deserts. And so there may be areas in the state where you don't have that access. And you, again, the same thing with OB deserts. You don't have transportation. You're trying to figure out, well, do I get food for my family or do I go to a doctor visit? And so it may be the same thing with mental health. And the connection is that, you know, if there are substances available that can help with your anxiety, help with your depression, you're going to utilize that simply because that's what you have at hand. And so I think that one of the things as a state, if we can increase the access to mental health providers and be sure that all women have access to substance use disorder care, which we're getting much better at now. We weren't there 5 or even 10 years ago, but we're getting much better at providing access so women that have issues regarding substance use disorder can get care. And then now we're finding as we need to make sure that they continue that care even after they deliver. A lot of our moms that die from substance use disorder due to overdose, they die in that back part, which is 43 days to 365 days. That woman has usually stopped seeing her obstetric provider after that 42-day mark. And so we have to even get women into care after that 43 days when the pregnancy has been completed. You know, one of the things the state has done is they've created, they got this grant, the Mommy Grant, the Indiana Pregnancy Promise Program. And so a woman who has been identified with substance use disorder from opiates is able to enroll in this program, and it gets her into care during pregnancy as well as after pregnancy for up to a year afterwards. So if she's been using medication-assisted therapy such as buprenorphine, she can continue to get that care even after she delivers, and they will continue paying for that medication, and her Medicaid insurance will continue as well.
What are some of the things that are being done maybe to educate mothers? I mean, I guess it just depends on if they have access to be able to get that information. But I was thinking about just some of these risks, you know, as someone who had kids myself, I don't remember, and again, it was long ago, but I don't remember stuff being talked about, like if you hemorrhage or if this happens, or, you know, so I think sometimes women are unaware of what's happening to their bodies.
You know, they are. And hopefully, for the most part, we're getting facilities where the women will deliver to almost be protocol driven. So if you see a hemorrhage, you need to do X, Y, and Z. Even if you only as a facility may see that that type of hemorrhage once a year, you have to have those things set up. And so you want to make sure that the facility that you go to pays attention and has, you know, various, you know, certifications or accreditations. But for the most part, the state with the levels of care program is doing that for women. And those are some of the things I was talking about earlier, where the state has, through the levels of care, made sure that facilities have adequate resources such as blood products. If you deliver, you know, in a level one hospital versus a level four, where level four is the highest, you want to make sure that you have the right kind of care. If you're identified as a high risk mother, you're delivering in the correct facility. And so the state has started going through and credentialing each of the hospitals for the appropriate level. And so if you're identified as a woman who is going to need the highest level, you should be getting and seeking care in the highest level facility.
When it comes to the obstetric deserts, I know we only have a few minutes left here. It seems like things are getting there are less resources available for folks. Is this because we've just forgotten about rural areas? Are people assuming there's midwives out there to deliver the babies? What do you see?
You know, so we know that about a third of our counties are what we call an obstetric desert, meaning there's neither a delivering facility or there's not an obstetric provider, provided that's an OBGYN or a family medicine delivers. You know, our report showed that about 15% of our maternal deaths occurred where the woman last resided in an obstetric desert. I think most of the time, it's purely an economic choice for, you know, the hospitals, whether they provide obstetric care or not. If you are only delivering 50 patients annually, that's for a month, but yet you have to maintain the correct safety structure. You have to have this correct personnel 24/7, 365. And so it becomes quite expensive sometimes to be sure that you can adequately deliver anyone who walks through that door, because sometimes that's what happens. And so if you live in a sparsely populated area, economically, it's going to be very expensive for you as a hospital to maintain if you're only doing 50 deliveries annually. So to me, it's purely an economic decision. But there are some areas where a woman might have to travel more than, you know, 60 to even 90 minutes. And so we have to identify that maybe even if it costs that much, we have to have some facility in an ideal location for those patients.
Right. Or, I mean, I'm thinking even at least in some urgent care setting, someone that can deliver the baby if need be.
Yes. And I'm sure there are a lot of ER providers out there who have delivered a lot of babies for that very reason.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Dr. Abernathy. Before we go to break, is there any solution that you think could improve maternal health care in Indiana?
You know, I've kind of spoken about increasing health care access for mental health conditions. I think that is a big one. We've also find that about 2/3 of the women who have experienced a death have been somehow entered into the Department of Child Services. And so there has to be a way we can identify women who are at higher risk because they've either as a victim or a perpetrator been in the DCS system.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Mary Abernathy, chair of Indiana's Maternal Mortality Review Committee. We'll be back after a quick break. I'm Miriam Sobe, and this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're discussing maternal mortality in Indiana and what's been done to raise awareness and improve maternal health care for mothers across the country as well as here in our state. We're joined now by Stephanie Trendowski, a mother, business professor, and maternal health ambassador for Mom Congress, to hear her personal story of childbirth and overcoming the challenges she faced during her pregnancy. Thank you so much, Stephanie, for joining us and open to sharing this story with us.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor.
Your childbirth story was one that was highlighted in the Joy in Jeopardy series. What made you want to share your story? And can you tell us a little bit about what you faced?
Absolutely. So I've actually pretty much been an open book about our experience since I had my daughter in 2016. And, you know, the work that we do with the Preeclampsia Foundation, Mom Congress, Mama's Voices are all organizations that I'm a part of. And we really do encourage to educate, advocate, and collaborate. So we do, you know, we say that it's never too late to learn about something. You know, somebody will say, oh, I'm past childbearing ages. Well, you either have a mother, you know a mother, or you are a mother. So it's very important for everyone to know, you know, these experiences that we have gone through so that we don't feel like we're alone.
The irony, I think, I'm just thinking of my own experiences. It's like when you're pregnant or having your baby, everyone seems to forget everything. And then later when they have their kids, they're like, oh, it was this and this. I'm like, yeah, well, I was all alone and nobody listened to me.
Exactly. Yeah, that's we actually one of the things that I experienced is we call the three deadly D's, the delay, denial, and dismissal. And in my experience, I had worked in healthcare previously before I was a professor. And I knew enough to know what was going on and just to listen to my body that something wasn't right. And I was actually told by my OB to put my blood pressure cuff away because I was getting high readings and he thought it was just anxiety related, but it was actually the start of preeclampsia from the middle of my second trimester. So we're just really encouraging women to be aware of your body and listen to your body and that there are no silly questions and that these doctor's offices and nurses and midwives, you know, need to take everything seriously, whether it's anxiety related or not.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that pregnant women sometimes are downplayed in their concerns? I don't know why. I mean, I can't give a reason why, but I just feel that sometimes, you know, you'll be expressing something and it's like, no, relax. You're emotional. Oh,
absolutely. When I actually met a dear friend now, working when we were back in DC a few years ago, when we were at Congress, and she actually was full term and lost her son due to HELLP syndrome because the physicians were saying that she was overreacting. And, you know, so that's what really got me involved in maternal health with our Black Mama sisters because she just so happens to be one because they just were not listening to her. And she ended up losing her son and almost losing her own life. So she now advocates beside us and we're so fortunate to have her.
I'm so sorry to hear that. And there have been reports, I know, that show that women of color face a lot more difficulties with pregnancy and healthcare and being listened to. You mentioned you had preeclampsia. What is that for those who might not know what that is?
So I actually had a high risk pregnancy the entire time. So I was supposed to be on high watch, you know, from the very beginning. But preeclampsia is usually noticed by high blood pressure at some point in the pregnancy. Mine was in the second trimester, or they check for protein in your urine when you go in for your visits. And I wasn't getting a high enough protein in the dip, so I requested to have a 24-hour urinalysis where you have to take it home and go for 24 hours and take it back to the lab. And my levels were high, but they weren't high enough, supposedly, for my OB to be worried about. So I was exhibiting all of these signs. And finally, I just asked to see a maternal fetal medicine specialist. And they said, sure, we can send you, but it's probably just going to be a peace of mind visit. They'll probably just send you home. And sure enough, we found out my baby's fluid levels were dangerously low due to the ignored preeclampsia that was already occurring. And, I was sent to the hospital that day, to prepare for her delivery within the next 3 days.
Wow. That's gotta be really scary to have to go through something like that so sudden.
Yes, it was scary. I was more worried about her survival. At that point, I was just under 31 weeks, and she was born at 31 weeks, 3 days. So I wasn't really thinking about myself at that point. But of course, then after everything transpired, the medical staff was more worried about Mama because she was thriving, luckily, in the NICU.
How did you cope after all of this experience? It sounds like a near-death experience.
It was very tough. I took to social media and started following Facebook pages and researching what happened to me, HELLP syndrome, what it was, you know, hemolysis, elevated liver enzymes, low platelets, who else had lost their vision like I had. My pressures were so high 7 days postpartum before I was diagnosed that I had retinal detachment. And luckily it was just fluid behind my retinas. But if it hadn't been resolved, then I could have been legally blind forever, not just for the few months that I was. So I took to social media and just started reading, connecting with other moms. One of my friends that I actually met is across the world in Australia. We had very similar experiences, and our daughters are very close in age. So we connected, and I said, you know, like the story said, that they published, you know, meant for more. I knew that I had to take our experience and say, okay, changes need to be made. What can we do now that we know that this is what happens in these supposed extreme cases? What can we do to change that in the future for moms?
Well, I think that's amazing. You're able to push forward and be a voice for so many women. When you were discharged from the hospital after you had your daughter, you reached out to an attorney's office to see if you could file a lawsuit or get compensated for medical bills and emotional trauma. What did the attorney's office tell you?
Yeah, that was actually quite some time after. At that point, I was just, you know, happy to be alive. And I was just grateful that we were both here. We had both survived. And, you know, so many people had brought it up to me. And I just thought, you know what? No, it's okay. You know, we're both alive. And finally, I did look into it. And I was discouraged. I actually spoke to a medical advisor for an attorney's office for over an hour easily on the phone. And they basically told me because I made it and she made it, we would spend years and a lot of money fighting this and we probably would not win, so that it wasn't worth it. And just hearing that any mother's experience like this isn't worth it just shows me that there is something that needs to be changed with the state and at the federal level in the courts.
Do you know if they take the data, like for your situation, what happened to you, do they put that in the records at all with pregnancy related issues so it can be documented?
Well, I'm called a near miss situation. So the Maternal Mortality Review Committees, obviously, that they were speaking of earlier, I wouldn't be part of that because I was not a mortality case. I'm a morbidity case. So it's near death. So, of course, I have all of my records from the hospital. And when we do stories, you know, like this, that's where we get all of the fine details of what exactly was happening. But to my knowledge, I don't think anything like that is reported. when I work with the local hospitals here in Northwest Indiana, you know, there are administrators that will say, why didn't we know about her case? You know, we need to know about this. We need to educate, you know, our floors about this and our nurses about this if somebody else comes in with something like her experience. So that's what we're really working together. I've got a great relationship with the hospitals up here, and just, you know, the boards and meeting with them and saying, okay, here's how we can make a difference. You know, if a mom comes in, you know, make sure we're going over those toolkits that Dr. Abernathy had mentioned. I was fortunate to be one of the authors on the hypertensive toolkit for the Indiana Perinatal Quality Improvement Collaborative. So, you know, just making sure that these hospitals and facilities are following through with all of these steps to ensure that our moms are safe when they're walking into a situation like this.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like there's just a lot of lack of communication and organization, which seems to be the case for so many things happening in our world. But just taking that step, seeing what you're doing, Dr. Abernathy, and even the Indy Star reporting on this, hopefully this can cause some positive changes to occur. Since your experience, you've been involved in advocacy around mental health care in Indiana as well, maternal health care, sorry. What kind of advocacy work do you do in the state?
Absolutely. So here in the state of Indiana, I'm part of the IPQIC. So I was actually invited to be part of that by Dr. Box, who is our health commissioner. I have worked with senators and representatives. So Senator Melton up here in Northwest Indiana and former Representative Lisa Beck in Northwest Indiana. And I have co-authored proclamations with both of them, naming May the month of the mother. So we're just, you know, bringing more awareness to mothers in Indiana, and especially with the mortality rates. When I was first in DC years ago, working with Mom Congress, we had the third highest maternal mortality in the nation and the sixth highest infant mortality in the nation. So that's what just kind of drove my passion to come back here to the state and get to work. And I just started working with local legislators and state senators, you know, Dr. Braun's office. We've been in contact with him about a few of our bills. And I do work with an organization called Mom Congress. It's based out of California with 2020 Mom. But we have ambassadors all over the United States, as well as the Preeclampsia Foundation based in Florida. And I am on the Patient Advisory Council and the Subcommittee for Research. And there are about 10 of us, I believe, on that.
Well, tell us about Mom Congress. What does Mom Congress do? Do they push for laws? Do they educate folks?
Yeah, so we actually have, if you go to momcongress.com, if anyone is interested, we have what's called the Momnibus. And the laws that they were speaking of earlier took me back to H.R. 1318, which is the Preventing Maternal Deaths Act of 2017. And that's actually what was originally responsible for creating those maternal mortality review committees across the United States. So if you look at our Momnibus, it changes. But every year we have three typical buckets: paid family leave, maternal health, and maternal mental health.
Something that I just thought about right now as we're talking here is how could mothers advocate for themselves even when maybe the system isn't allowing them to use their voice? Is there anything that women who are listening, who are pregnant, that want to make sure that they're getting the proper care can do?
That's definitely something that, you know, in my experience, is a shortcoming in the medical field, especially for someone who has worked in the medical field. That's why it's so important to have family members or friends or anyone that's near you to help be an advocate for you. You know, the fact that I had to beg to be readmitted to the hospital postpartum and then I was in the ICU that night, to me, is completely unacceptable. And with all due respect to, you know, many medical practitioners that I know, we shouldn't be the ones having to beg to be readmitted. And, you know, if I was a mom who just blindly listened to my physician and went home, I most likely would have passed away from a stroke or a heart attack due to my condition at home. So I just tell moms to make sure you educate yourself and those around you, and to never be afraid to, as we say, use your mom voice And yeah, that's what Mama's Voices and Preeclampsia Foundation came up with. That catchphrase there is use your mom voice, and just don't be afraid, you know, because we know our bodies better than anyone else.
Absolutely. And I don't know. I don't know if I should ever use my mom voice. are there any bills you're currently working on to get passed at the state level or federal level?
At the state level right now, I had been working back and forth with a few different things. You know, I've, of course, been working on the toolkits, and that kind of took up time, especially during the pandemic. But right now we're focusing on the Momnibus for 2021. We will be returning back to Washington, D.C. In May of 2022. So we'll be heading back there and getting things back to normal, so to speak, after everything that's been going on. Of course, you know, we are focusing a lot more on our Black mamas and the disparities, racial disparities that are happening with their births. So that's one of the main focuses, that and paid family leave.
Have you found that working on these projects have helped sort of with the healing process from the trauma you encountered?
Oh, absolutely. I'm not one to use our story for attention whatsoever, but to bring awareness. That's what I tell people, is we can get our story out there. I have people messaging me from the Indy Star story, from Muncie and Indianapolis and all over the state, just saying, hey, I'm so-and-so. I went through something similar. Thank you for sharing your story. So it's a healing process for me. And just knowing that if our story can save other moms in the future, that's what it's all about.
And so what is next for you coming up with any of these projects? Is there anything you're working on that we can check out?
Sure. So yeah, you can go to the Preeclampsia Foundation to read about the new research that's going on. There's always updates on that. We work directly with the CDC and ACOG and Merck for Mothers. You can go to Mom Congress to see the Momnibus, which changes every year. So you can see what our previous Momnibus bills have been in the past that we have worked on. And of course, you can feel free to contact me at movingmountainsformoms@gmail.com.
And so for folks who are listening that may want to get involved with any of these efforts, what do you advise the first step is?
I'd say, you know, contact one of our organizations, contact us directly, you know, like I did, just hop on social media, look up, you know, did you suffer from a hemorrhage? Did you suffer from preeclampsia? Find the people that are like us, find your people, and, you know, just pick up the phone and start making phone calls and making those visits to your local, Senate office and your local representative offices.
All right. Well, Stephanie, I want to thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure to have you on, and thank you again for sharing your story.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Stephanie Trendowski is a maternal health ambassador for Mom Congress and one of the mothers featured on the Indy Star's Joy in Jeopardy project. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. If you want to keep in touch with us, have a question or a comment, or just want to say hi, find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soap. Thank you so much for listening. This is All In.